You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Theirtube. YouTube has helped to fundamentally remake the way we think about fame, clout, and the very idea of entertainment. As it prepares to turn 15, Richard Lawson surveys a generation of creators, discovering their cultural power and, sometimes, their limits. With photographs by Ethan James Green. Emma Chamberlain, age 18, genre, lifestyle, and comedy. First post, June 2017. Subscribers, 8.43 million. It's like you're doing 10 people's jobs at once, says Chamberlain of the YouTuber grind, filming, editing, and of course being the on-air personality. It's a crazy amount of work. And yet Chamberlain always seems to be having fun, even when tired or stressed or dealing with the latest zit. That energy has proven infectious. Chamberlain's rise on the platform has been meteoric, though hopefully with less flaming out than that term suggests. There are multiple stages of burnout for sure, Chamberlain says. I'm surprisingly not in one right now. I'm actually kind of enjoying the process right now, which is amazing and rare for creators. Emma Chamberlain is 18 years old and grew up watching YouTube videos. Over the past 2 years, she has entered the fray herself, becoming one of the most dynamic contributors to Google's video hosting behemoth, posting prosaic videos documenting her misadventures as a nascently independent adolescent. She vlogs trips to Coachella and fashion halls and tours of Los Angeles's many coffee shops. Her subscriber count hasn't yet topped 9 million, but her videos regularly earn 5, 6, 7 million views each, an engagement rate that's proved enticing to Louis Vuitton, which commissioned a video from Chamberlain for its 2020 cruise collection, and contribute to a very healthy teenage income. Though an imprecise science at best, the tracking company Social Blade estimates her revenue from views alone to be as high as six figures some months. She is as au courant as one can get on YouTube. Cool, self-deprecating, exuberantly youthful, slightly world-weary, and utterly of the platform. When I spoke to her on the phone this summer, Chamberlain was chipper and sanguine about her life and career online, relishing in the continuing evolution of a still new concept she's always known. I didn't have cable, so YouTube was my cartoons, she told me of her childhood. What Chamberlain has witnessed in her lifespan is the burgeoning of an enormous medium, one that encompasses so many forms, genres, and styles that to describe it is, in essence, to talk about the whole planet. It's like you have the little hometown that just has one-story buildings and little ice cream shops and stuff, Chamberlain says of the earlier, quainter YouTube. But now there's like malls and apartments. New names and tropes pop up overnight like mushrooms. Throughout my own metastasizing addiction to the platform, it's taken many shapes. I've watched the sudden rises and gentler falls of so many sunny YouTubers, Brits and Angelinos, and people beaming in from God knows where. I love commentary videos and food videos, and aviation vlogs covering first-class flights, I'll never take. YouTube fame is a fickle, mercurial thing. It's entirely possible that Chamberlain will be passé by year's end. But I doubt that. She's uniquely trained, through the osmosis of nearly lifelong fandom, to maneuver the platform with preternatural ease. I feel like if I start to calculate too much and strategize too much, I'll just lose who I am in it, and I'll lose my career also, she says. If I'm making videos I'm proud of, the rest doesn't matter. Worst comes to worst, everyone stops caring, but I'm still making videos that I love, and I'll get a job somewhere else. That sense of uncertainty, optimism, and fatalism commingling in a very Gen Z way pervades pretty much any conversation one has with a YouTuber these days. The creators seem restless. YouTubers are now, nearly 15 years after its inception, enjoying what could be called the beginnings of finally bestowed legitimacy, the first indications of real longevity. That's not just because, say, Lily Singh, a stalwart YouTube star, debuted her own NBC late night show in September. The YouTube to TV conversion has been happening for a while now, with folks like Colleen Ballinger, also known as Miranda Sings, and Grace Helbig having spells in more traditional entertainment. Really, the digital creator class's legitimacy is arising out of the passage of time. YouTube fame isn't novel to Gen Zers. It simply is. The third epoch. This July, I traveled to VidCon, an annual convention held in Anaheim for digital creators, to survey the scene, as I had done 4 years ago when YouTube stardom was a newer and stranger thing, and was met with an even more skeptical eye than it is now. The idea that one can earn a living posting videos on the internet has inured itself to our economy. With that has come feelings of satisfaction and stability for some. For other creators, it's led to new stresses and concerns. VidCon was flashier and sleeker this year than it was in 2015. More major media outlets covered the event. The brands were bigger. YouTubers exist in a strange liminal spot at the moment, then. Both hugely famous and not famous at all, depending on the age bracket you talk to. As YouTube has gotten bigger, the broader and less high-minded appetites of the public have elbowed out the softer, gentler content of old. YouTube used to be a place where the weirdos and the outcast would go to find comfort and find their community, says Joy Graceffa, a veteran creator who now stars in YouTube Premium's Escape the Night. Now, it's almost like the popular kids kind of infiltrated our secret hideout. He meant, I think, the kind of big, noisy, brash, vine to YouTube emigres who have come to define the latter site's roughly third epoch. There are so many clearly staged prank videos and look at my fancy cars flexing videos now that it's easy to forget that YouTube celebrity began with earnest kids on the edge of their beds. This new class of creators has infected YouTube with a witless braggadocio that has, on occasion, given way to real offense, such as the video Logan Paul posted after encountering the scene of a suicide. The mix of the maybe accidentally obscene and the silly has become a hallmark of the current YouTube. Paul got a lot of views, but they came with a revulsion of millions, especially when the story went mainstream. The outside world was suddenly paying attention, and it didn't like what it saw. While a lot of YouTube content is fun and eminently consumable, a lot of it is flimsy at best. Sifting through all the pranks and rambling story times, the boyfriend challenges in which no one's actually dating each other, and the endless stream of person-tries-food videos, YouTube looks pretty weak next to the output of most traditional media. The laziness of many of YouTube's biggest stars makes a viewer feel frustrated and helpless about the future of entertainment. "We don't get to decide what's quality," says Chris Wattine, an agent at CAA who represents popular creators. That was a chilling sentiment to absorb amid the clamor of the Hilton Anaheim, where the biggest talent was cordoned away from the masses and the riot of the convention. Witten and many others insisted to me that the line between video content and TV or movies is ever blurring. That seems like more of a talking point than a reality when one compares YouTube to, say, Netflix's output. But there is an undeniable sense of it as a soon-to-be totalizing force. Eyeballs and burnout at scale. Ashley Margolis runs the A-List, a marketing company that connects brands with social media influencers. We spoke in her sprawling Beverly Hills showroom, skylighted and stuffed with products. Shoes, dresses, bespoke cannabis paraphernalia that creators will tout to their legion of followers. "Some clients don't want YouTubers," Margolis says, "but we have slowly been convincing them. Trust us, the eyeballs are huge here if you want to convert to sales. If your demographic is the millennials, then this is where you have to be." Therein may lie the answer to any existential pondering of this whole enterprise. Like so much else that's preceded it, the utility of YouTube can be boiled down to what it's able to sell. Many top-tier creators are becoming extraordinarily wealthy under the gaze of all of those eyeballs. Some buy Lamborghinis, others just let their new, nicer homes hang in the background, a subtle acknowledgement of what digital fame has afforded them. During VidCon, I sat down with Crystal Hauserman, Senior Director of Marketing and Communications for the digital talent agency Fullscreen, in a Hilton conference room the company had done up to look like a trendy enchanted forest. I asked her a vexing question for any industry that relies on the fleeting attention of young people. How do you foster longevity for a YouTuber's career? Is it even possible, considering how many once huge YouTubers have since been relegated to Arcana? "We don't want that life cycle to be 24 months, she says. "It's something we're really focused on, growing with clients. A big topic at VidCon this year was the concept of burnout, a feeling of creative exhaustion and frustration. That stress is often a product of not knowing what to do with one's channel once it's achieved a certain degree of visibility. How does one feel secure in a forever scaling and demanding industry? I'll get comments from people, and they'll be like, 'You should have way more subscribers. You should be bigger,' says Jackie Aina, whose beauty and fashion channel has a solid but not mega-size fan base. And I'm like, at what point is 3 million going to be success? Smaller channels. And yes, 3 million subscribers is relatively small, can still be lucrative. But the busier YouTube has gotten, the harder it is for the stranger and more interesting stuff to gain any real attention. Many such YouTubers have forgone ad revenue, earning a living from donations. On YouTube, fame has almost become a stand-in term for existence. A certain number of subscribers means you can stay, that there's a point to all your uploading, but then you have to figure out how to sustain and profit from it. Plenty of other YouTubers are happy to be obsessed with numbers. Collins Key, who makes loud and antic videos involving slime and food for a rapacious audience of mostly children, has close to 20 million subscribers. His videos, on average, garner about 29 million views, he says. Paying attention to those stats is a core part of Key's business. There's no need to take unnecessary creative risk, he tells me, his pale blue eyes and intense bar mitzvah hype man energy boring into me. With a TV show, you create a season, and then it goes out, and then you find out how it does. For us, we're getting weekly feedback. Such industrialization has proven too much for some of YouTube's older guard, the version 1.0 or 2.0 stars, who generously built the infrastructure that many less techie, less wonky creators now enjoy, who have faded from or abandoned the platform. Charlie McDonnell, a retiring, science-minded Brit, was once the biggest YouTuber in the United Kingdom. More than a decade later, at age 29, he's off the platform entirely. I feel like I didn't really know how I wanted to present myself on YouTube, he says. To be someone who was more fun and interesting than I was in real life, which is what I think every YouTuber does, I realized I liked who I was in real life more than the guy I was being on screen. McConnell recalls, wistfully, the bygone days when a creator could directly email the guy who ran YouTube's homepage. These days, nearly every creator I spoke to seemed haunted and awed by the platform's fabled algorithm. They spoke of it as one would a vague god or as a scapegoat, explaining away the fading of clout or relevance. Double-edged agnosticism. The sleepy channels of once white-hot YouTube legends like Tyler Oakley or any number of Brit Squad folks like Marcus Butler offer ample proof that YouTube fame is fleeting, but while talk of sustainability animates so much conversation in the YouTube space, there is something darker threatening or overshadowing the whole shiny economy so proudly on display at events like VidCon. Thanks to the tech libertarian streak that governs YouTube and much of Silicon Valley, there is a lot of noxious material on the platform, and it has gained traction in direct proportion to the sunnier stuff, particularly videos promoting white supremacy, misogyny, and other grim ideologies. What works so well for the daylight side of YouTube, its inviting intimacy, its conversational ease, the algorithmic nudges down rabbit holes, is chillingly effective for the bad stuff, too. YouTube is moderated to some extent. There is some vague shape to it, the borders of which can be seen in the distance. Up close, it's infinite chaos, a clamoring reflection of our disparate needs and interest. It is clearinghouse and shelter, a place that doesn't so much directly challenge and destroy orthodoxy as much as flatten it into nothing. In that way, there's a direct line connecting some kids' earnest coming-out video and neo-Nazi content. Carlos Maza, a 31-year-old producer and writer who makes political YouTube videos for Vox, has had direct and galling experience with the platform at its worst. Maza is gay and Latino and politically progressive, a trifecta that has earned him the angry attention of an insidious and highly active group of users. He's been so harassed for calling out what he sees as pervasive, and in his situation, personal, bigotry, that he had to leave his house for several days earlier this year amid threats. Throughout that ordeal, Maza says he saw a callousness from YouTube that began to seem downright irresponsible, he told me in a knotty, intense conversation over lunch this June. I realized that there's no appealing to YouTube's better angels, he says. They only react to crises. No one in that organization at the top is asking what's the right thing to do. They're asking what's the least we can do to avoid this crisis. Massa suggested to me that he doesn't think the platform can be saved. Our conversation made me think the real issue is whether humanity can be. Therein lies the problem of YouTube and other social media platforms. When you invite the world in, it's hard to be retroactively selective. YouTube has gotten a bit stricter with its content policies, mostly in the wake of PR disasters like Massa's situation. But there's still a continent of gray area. Gray, as far as YouTube's rules are concerned, at least, that makes the platform a pretty treacherous place. What are slime videos doing next to people peddling race science, anyway? Cat Black is a sharp, insightful YouTuber who addresses white supremacy and other urgent topics in spoken essays. When I met her at VidCom, she was both energized and innervated, explaining that the platform's agnosticism is double-edged. On one hand, it allows people like me to be able to speak up for themselves and to be heard and be seen in a way that they wouldn't have been in regular media, she says. But it also allows people like white nationalists to organize and speak out in a way that, again, they wouldn't in regular media. Over breakfast one morning in Anaheim, I ask Andrea Faville, YouTube's corporate communications head, about its strategy for mitigating all this troublesome content. When you have creators who have very large fan bases that can kind of take on a life of their own in terms of going after someone, how do you take action, but also not hold creators accountable for something they might have no control over? She asked in return, which seemed a bit shifty, because of course creators are not immediately responsible for what their fans do, but they are still the ones inspiring those fans into action, indirectly or not. I pushed Faville for how YouTube positions itself as an editorial entity. Clearly, it champions certain creators as shining beacons of the platform when the opportunity is convenient, in marketing campaigns and whatnot. She gave me a careful answer and more questions. I think about it less as an editorial decision. It's about our responsibility. There's the video hosting side of YouTube, but it's also a community. And the question is, as a platform, what is our responsibility to that community? How do we do this responsibly, while also keeping this as an open platform where there are going to be a lot of different opinions, a lot of different perspectives, a lot of different types of speech? It's tricky. I wouldn't necessarily say we're Switzerland, but I think the vision is definitely that YouTube is always going to be a place where lots of different communities have an opportunity to share their perspective. That's not a satisfying response to the question of how a public company is going to handle the rampant and dangerous ideology on its platform, one that's accessible for young people, even those who innocently came to the site in search of, say, video game content. Faville says YouTube is working to address this stuff in a methodical, thorough way, mostly through enforcing increasingly stringent terms of use policies. Still, I thought about something that Black said to me. My thinking was, well, isn't YouTube going to feel guilty if they allow white nationalism to incubate on their platform? But I've learned they have no legal responsibility. They only care so much. Attention-seeking introverts. Before traveling to VidCon, I spent some time in Baltimore with Natalie Wynn, an apostate of academia whose ContraPoints channel is a fount of funny, hard-hitting, gorgeously articulated political discourse dressed up in drag world fabulousness. She showed me her windowless basement studio filled with lighting equipment, wigs, and other flair. Wynn is often labeled, along with Black and others, combating far-right content as a member of Left Tube. It was funny, then, that this great campaign is partially launched from such a humble space. Wynn is reticent to give herself too much credit, or even to accept the burden. Her growing following, which funds her through Patreon, means that she can live as a full-time YouTuber. That's essentially her ambition at the moment, and I found her enjoying a sense of artistic fulfillment. If she changes a heart or mind here and there along the way, well, that's nice, too. Despite all the rancor she has received, Wynn says she still loves her platform of choice. YouTube is kind of the perfect thing for me, she told me in her soothing, instructive tone. I don't know what I would do without it. My particular needs as a person are met very well by YouTube. The self-deprecating way to put it is, YouTube is the perfect venue for attention-seeking introverts. That's a refreshingly honest assessment, as was the conversation I had with Randy Sharp, a Manhattan theater director who makes appealing, generous cooking videos for her channel, Dinner Party Tonight. It has, for now, only 8,000 or so subscribers. We had a long meal together a few months ago, during which Sharp told me about the intense feeling of connection she shares with some of her fans. I had one lady, oh my God, she wrote me, she's probably 40 or 45. She says, my husband died unexpectedly, and I've been holed up in my house for 2 years, and I started watching your videos. My husband and I used to entertain all the time, and it made me sick to think about having people over. And this sent me over the moon, she says. I just had some people over for the first time in 2 years. I like what that says about YouTube's purest possibility. Reporting on the digital world is taxing because it can make one feel so irreducibly old and out of touch and alarmed about the future. But YouTube stretches out with long arms, and some of them do somehow reach good enough places. When I got home from my dinner with Sharp, I made myself a drink and opened YouTube yet again, expectant and spent, and went exploring. There was that planet entire, messy, roiling, and lively in all its risky enthusiasm to be seen. Ethan and Grayson Dolan, age 19, genre, lifestyle, and comedy, first post, July 2014, subscribers, 10.4 million. If there's anything YouTube likes, it's cute boys and brothers. The Dolan twins satisfy both interests. The pair are part of the large contingent of current YouTubers who migrated from Vine, the now-shuttered Microforum video app and meme factory, crossing a land bridge that's now underwater. A little slicker than the Dobry brothers, and a little less crass than the Paul brothers, the Dolans don't really put much art into their videos, but they possess that rare alchemical quality that converts basic being into ardent fandom. Natalie Wynn, age 30, genre, social commentary, first post, April 2016, subscribers, 733,000. I didn't want to be the person who was just making videos about social justice videos on YouTube, says Wynn, also known as ContraPoints, about the genesis of her channel. To me, it was like I may as well be lecturing again. I tried that, and I hated it, and I don't want to be that person. Wynn is an escapee from academia, now enjoying the freedom and levity allowed by self-employed content creation. She still covers serious topics, though, and is often credited with leading some viewers out of the darkness of the far right. I thought that I could find a place for myself as a sort of unexpected counterbalance to the reactionary stuff. Mark Fishbach, age 30, genre gaming, first post, May 2012, subscribers 24.3 million. Gaming is huge on YouTube, perhaps the most dominant category on the platform. Fishbach, also known as Markiplier, is a stalwart star, a king of the Let's Play genre. The uninitiated may wonder why anyone would want to sit at their computer and watch someone else play a video game, but Fishbach and his ilk make a case for it, infusing their videos with a hypersense of drama, playing every bit like it's the final of the World Cup. Fishbach has parlayed his gaming success into comedy and charity, the latter initiative raising hundreds of thousands of dollars for various worthy causes over the years. Glozell Green, age 47, genre comedy, first post January 2008, subscribers 5 million. Green is one of the OG YouTube stars, an aspiring comedian who saw the potential in digital video before a lot of others did. Her status as a pioneer once got the attention of the Obama White House, which invited her to interview the president for her channel. As new generations of creators have emerged, though, Green has felt a little left out in the cold. It would be nice if YouTube were like, oh, you've been here for a while? Let me help you out with this and that, because it is so saturated and you've been loyal. That would be nice, but that's with any company. Cat Black, age 28, genre social commentary, first post 2005, subscribers 135,101. In a video from earlier this year titled Why is Left Tube So White?, Black expressed frustration that her commentary is often ignored in favor of white creators who are making the same progressive points. That issue may be institutional. It's always felt ironic to me how YouTube will do this song and dance about supporting the marginalized creators and wanting to create all these spaces, Black sighs, but then YouTube as a space doesn't feel welcoming, truly, to a lot of marginalized creators. Still, she says, when it comes to YouTube as a website, I'm more happy with it than I have been before. Jackie Aina, age 32, genre beauty and fashion, first post August 2009, subscribers 3.14 million. There's one thing that I think every creator sometimes needs to hear, Aina says of the YouTube racket. Excuse my French, but nobody owes you shit. Aina has operated with that ethos in mind while navigating her own online career, maintaining a strain of humor and humility even as the opportunities arising from her work in YouTube's most glamorized genre have grown ever more fabulous. Aina, who got her start in beauty while stationed in Hawaii as an Army reservist, is noticing a distinct shift in status as the platform evolves. 5-7 years ago, your favorite YouTuber was like the homie next door, but I feel like it's going to become, oh, she's a YouTuber. Kirsten Dirksen, age 49, genre lifestyle, first post January 2007, subscribers 1.07 million. One of the safest, most pleasant corners of YouTube is the one occupied by people who use the platform to do wholesome things like DIY projects and exploring tiny homes. Few do that with as much laid-back watchability as Dirksen. Her channel has been around since 2006, but really caught fire when tiny living and existing off the grid became a fashionable topic of fascination a few years ago. Dirksen matches her curiosity with our own, creating inviting videos that soothe as they inform. Would that all of YouTube could be so productive and comforting. Liza Koshy, age 23, genre comedy, first post July 2015, subscribers 25.2 million. One of the current queens of YouTube comedy, Koshy has her own scripted YouTube series, Liza on Demand. She directed an episode for the second season, for which she earned her Directors Guild of America card. She's also set to appear in a Netflix romantic comedy, perhaps the only genre of content as hot as YouTube at the moment. But Koshy's sticking to her original YouTube channel, too. She hasn't gotten too big for that. Anyway, she sees all these platforms fusing into one big thing anyway. We're all melting into this giant space, she says, where we're sharing and being more candid. Miles High, age 26, genre beauty, first post January 7th, 2007, subscribers 793,563. YouTube, for all its imperfection, has been a vital outlet for many in the LGBTQ+ community to connect, commune, console, and encourage. Hi, whose channel features makeup and hair makeovers with a good dose of comedy, is one of the more prominent voices in that chorus. He's had his channel since 2008, making him a veteran's veteran, and his videos have been viewed for more than 94 million times. Hi has flourished on YouTube, even if YouTube hasn't always offered sturdy infrastructure to queer creators. Despite YouTube's public expressions of pride, many queer creators say, and a pending lawsuit alleges, the company has quietly restricted their content. Nicholas Ashbaugh, age 43, genre spirituality, first post September 2013, subscribers 151,000. For those seeking some kind of cosmic solace on their journey through YouTube, isn't everyone, Ashbaugh is here to help. Using astrology and tarot, he gives his viewers lengthy forecasts for each month, indicating what joys and obstacles could await them. Whether or not you believe in all this stuff, Ashbaugh's videos have an undeniable allure. Maybe it's the way he so plainly states what could be viewed by some as out there and woo-woo, or it could be how pleasingly thorough Ashbaugh is in his predictions. Whatever the reason, his is a calm and rejuvenating niche on a platform that so often feels sick with stress and noise. Tati Westbrook, age 37, genre, beauty, first post, November 2010, subscribers 9.77 million. The beauty space on YouTube is, for a variety of reasons, a breeding ground for drama. Feuds, clapbacks, and outright cancellations have happened en masse in the genre in recent years. None knows that better than Westbrook, who called out her former protege James Charles in a long video that went mega viral in May. Outlets that don't normally cover YouTube picked up the story, a sign that digital stars will soon be part of the gossip industry, the same as any other celeb. But as happens with all these things, the sort of scandal blew over quickly, and now Westbrook is on to other things. She and other beauty gurus now all the more aware of the social peril lurking around every corner. Once Upon a Time in Burbank. A $7 billion deal with Steve Jobs and Pixar ushered in a new era of prosperity for Disney. In an exclusive from his new book, CEO Bob Iger opens up about how an unlikely friendship made magic. Opening photo, Double Vision. Bob Iger and Steve Jobs in 2006, 8 months after the Disney-Pixar deal. Look what we did, Jobs later said. We saved two companies. This article is adapted from The Ride of a Lifetime, Lessons Learned from 15 Years as CEO of the Walt Disney Company by Robert Iger, published September 23, 2019 by Random House, a division of Penguin Random House, LLC. Copyright 2019 by Robert Iger. In January 2006, I joined Steve Jobs in Emeryville, California, to announce Disney's acquisition of Pixar, the acclaimed animation studio chaired by Steve. I had become CEO of Disney just 3 months prior, and the deal represented an enormous opportunity and risk for the company and me personally. The plan that day was to release the announcement after the stock market closed at 1 p.m. Pacific time, then hold a press conference and a town hall meeting with Pixar's employees. Just after noon, Steve pulled me aside. "Let's take a walk," he said. I knew Steve liked to go on long walks, frequently with friends or colleagues, but I was surprised at the timing and suspicious about his request. I wondered whether he wanted to back out of the deal or renegotiate its terms. I looked at my watch. It was 12:15. We walked for a while and then sat on a bench in the middle of Pixar's beautiful manicured grounds. Steve put his arm behind me, which was a nice, unexpected gesture. He said, "I'm going to tell you something that only Laureen, his wife, and my doctors know." He asked me for complete confidentiality, and then he told me that his cancer had returned. "Steve," I said, "why are you telling me this now? I am about to become your biggest shareholder and a member of your board," he said, "and I think I owe you the right, given this knowledge, to back out of the deal." It was 12:30, only 30 minutes before we were to announce. I wasn't sure how to respond, and I was struggling to process what I'd just been told, which included asking myself whether what I now knew would trigger any disclosure obligations. He wanted complete confidentiality, so it would be impossible to do anything except accept his offer and back away from a deal I wanted badly and we needed badly. Finally, I said, "Steve, in less than 30 minutes, we are set to announce a $7+ billion deal. What would I tell our board? That I got cold feet?" He told me to blame him. I then asked, "Is there more than I need to know about this? Help me make this decision." He told me the cancer was now in his liver, and he talked about the odds of beating it. He was going to do whatever it took to be at his son Reed's high school graduation, he said. When he told me that was 4 years away, I felt devastated. It was impossible to be having these two conversations, about Steve facing his impending death and about the deal we were supposed to be closing in minutes, at the same time. I decided to reject his offer. Even if I took him up on it, I wouldn't have been able to explain why to our board, which not only had approved it, but had endured months of my pleas to do so. It was now 10 minutes before our release was to go out. I had no idea if I was doing the right thing, but I'd quickly calculated that Steve was not material to the deal itself, although he certainly was material to me. We walked in silence back to the atrium. That night, I took my wife, Willow Bay, into my confidence. Willow had known Steve for years, since long before I knew him, and instead of toasting what had been a momentous day in my early tenure as CEO, we cried together over the news. No matter what he told me, no matter how resolved he would be in his fight with cancer, we dreaded what was ahead for him. That Steve and I were standing on that stage together at all was something of a miracle. Before I became CEO, Disney's relationship with Pixar and Steve was in tatters. In the 90s, Disney struck a deal to co-produce, market, and distribute Pixar's films, starting with the enormously successful Toy Story, the world's first full-length digitally animated feature. Toy Story represented a seismic creative and technological leap, and it grossed nearly $400 million worldwide. It was followed by A Bug's Life in 1998 and Monsters, Inc. in 2001. Taken together, those three movies grossed well over $1 billion worldwide and established Pixar at a time when Disney animation was beginning to falter as the future of animation. Over the next 10 years, Disney released 5 additional Pixar films, including the hugely successful Finding Nemo and The Incredibles. But the relationship between Steve and my predecessor, Michael Eisner, started to falter. Attempts to renegotiate the terms of the deal or to extend the relationship met with failure, frustration, and rancor. And in January 2004, Steve made a very public, in-your-face announcement that he would never deal with Disney again. The end of the Pixar partnership was a huge blow from both a financial and a public relations standpoint. Steve was one of the most respected people in the world, and his rejection and withering criticism of Disney had been so public that any mending of that fence would be seen as a big early win for me as Disney's brand new CEO. Plus, Pixar was now the standard bearer in animation, and while I didn't yet have a complete sense of just how broken Disney animation was, I knew that any renewed partnership would be good for our business. I also knew that chances were slim that someone as headstrong as Steve would be open to something. But I had to try. I called Steve when it was announced I would succeed Michael as CEO, and while the call was hardly an icebreaker, we agreed to talk down the road. 2 months later, I reached out again. My ultimate goal was to somehow make things right with Pixar, but I couldn't ask for that initially. Steve's animosity toward Disney was too deep-rooted. I had an unrelated idea, though, that I thought might interest him. I told him I was a huge music lover and that I had all of my music stored on my iPod, which I used constantly. I'd been thinking about the future of television and believed it was only a matter of time before we would be accessing TV shows and movies on our computers. I didn't know how fast mobile technology was going to evolve. The iPhone was still 2 years away, so what I was imagining was an iTunes platform for television, ITV, as I described it. Steve was silent for a while, and then finally said, "I'm going to come back to you on this. I'm working on something I want to show you." A few weeks later, he flew down to Burbank. "You can't tell anyone about this," he said, "but what you're talking about with television shows, that's exactly what we've been imagining." He slowly withdrew a device from his pocket. "This is our new video iPod," he said. It had a screen the size of a couple of postage stamps. But he was talking about it like it was an IMAX theater. "This is going to allow people to watch video on our iPods, not just listen to music," he said. "If we bring this product to market, will you put your television shows on it?" I said yes, right away. Steve responded to boldness. Among his many frustrations was a feeling that it was often too difficult to get anything done with Disney. Every agreement needed to be vetted and analyzed to within an inch of its life, and that's not how he worked. I wanted him to understand that I didn't work that way either, that I was empowered to make a call, and that I was eager to figure out this future together and to do so quickly. That October, 5 months after that first conversation, and 2 weeks after I officially became CEO, Steve and I stood on stage together at the Apple launch and announced that 5 Disney shows, including 2 of the most popular on TV, Desperate Housewives and Lost, would now be available for download on iTunes and for consumption on the new iPod. The ease and the speed with which we got the deal done, combined with the fact that it showed an admiration for Apple and its products, blew Steve's mind. He told me he'd never met anyone in the entertainment business who was willing to try something that might disrupt his own company's business model. Those months spent talking with Steve began slowly, tentatively, to open up into discussions of a possible new Pixar deal. Steve had softened, but only a little. He was willing to talk, but his version of any new agreement was still very one-sided in Pixar's favor. The reality was, Steve had all of the leverage in the world. He never seemed worried about walking away. It was around this time that I had a radical idea. Disney should buy Pixar. In my first board meeting as CEO, I explained that it was imperative for me to figure out how to turn Disney Animation around. Throughout the late 80s and early 90s, the division had produced hit after hit. The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, and The Lion King. But then, amidst a number of high-profile management conflicts, the unit began to falter. The next several years would be dotted by a slew of expensive failures. Hercules, Atlantis, Treasure Planet, Fantasia 2000, Brother Bear, Home on the Range, and Chicken Little. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.